The set text was produced by Douglas Levy. The Dynasts, an epic drama of the war with Napoleon, in three parts, 19 acts, and 130 scenes, the time covered by the action being about 10 years, and I heard sounds of insult, shame, and wrong, and trumpets blown for wars. Preface: the spectacle here presented in the likeness of a drama is concerned with the great historical calamity, or clash of peoples, artificially brought about some 100 years ago. The choice of such a subject was mainly due to three accidents of locality. It chanced that the writer was familiar with a part of England that lay within hail of the watering place in which King George III had his favorite summer residence during the war with the first Napoleon, and where he was visited by ministers and others who bore the weight of English affairs on their more or less competent shoulders at that stressful time. Secondly, this district, being also near the coast which had echoed with rumors of invasion in their intensest form, while the descent threatened, was formerly animated by memories and traditions of the desperate military preparations for that contingency. Thirdly, the same countryside happened to include the village which was the birthplace of Nelson's flag captain at Trafalgar. When, as the first published result of these accidents, the Trumpet Major was printed, more than 20 years ago, I found myself in the tantalizing position of having touched the fringe of a vast international tragedy without being able, through limits of plan, knowledge, and opportunity, to enter further into its events, a restriction that prevailed for many years. But the slight regard paid to English influence and action throughout the struggle by those continental writers who had dealt imaginatively with Napoleon's career seemed always to leave room for a new handling of the theme which should re-embody the features of this influence in their true proportion. And accordingly, on a belated day about 6 years back, the following drama was outlined, to be taken up now and then at wide intervals ever since. It may, I think, claim at least a tolerable fidelity to the facts of its date as they are given ordinary records. Whenever any evidence of the words really spoken or written by the characters, in their various situations was attainable, as close a paraphrase has been aimed at as was compatible with the form chosen. And in all cases outside the oral tradition, accessible scenery, and existing relics, my indebtedness for detail to the abundant pages of the historian, the biographer, and the journalist, English and foreign, has been, of course, continuous. It was thought proper to introduce, as supernatural spectators of the terrestrial action, certain impersonated abstractions, or intelligences, called spirits. They are intended to be taken by the reader for what they may be worth as contrivances of the fancy merely. Their doctrines are but tentative, and are advanced with little eye to a systematized philosophy warranted to lift the burthen of the mystery of this unintelligible world. The chief thing hoped for them is that they, and their utterances may have dramatic plausibility enough to procure for them, in the words of Coleridge, that willing suspension of disbelief for the moment which constitutes poetic faith. The wide prevalence of the monistic theory of the universe forbade, in this 20th century, the importation of divine personages from any antique mythology as ready-made sources or channels of causation, even in verse, and excluded the celestial machinery of, say, Paradise Lost, as peremptorily as that of the Iliad or the Eddas. And the abandonment of the masculine pronoun in allusions to the first, or fundamental energy seemed a necessary and logical consequence of the long abandonment by thinkers of the anthropomorphic conception of the same. These phantasmal intelligences are divided in two groups, of which one only, that of the pities, approximates to the universal sympathy of human nature the spectator idealized, one, of the Greek chorus. It is impressionable, and inconsistent in its views, which sway hither and thither as wrought on by events. Another group approximates to the passionless insight of the ages. The remainder are eclectically chosen auxiliaries whose signification may be readily discerned. In point of literary form, the scheme of contrasted choruses and other conventions of this external feature was shaped with a single view to the modern expression of a modern outlook, and in frank divergence from classical and other dramatic precedent which ruled the ancient voicings of ancient themes. It may hardly be necessary to inform readers that in devising this chronicle piece no attempt has been made to create that completely organic structure of action and closely webbed development of character and motive which are demanded in a drama strictly self-contained. A panoramic show like the present is a series of historical ordinates, to use a term in geometry, : the subject is familiar to all, and foreknowledge is assumed to fill in the junctions required to combine the scenes into an artistic unity. Should the mental spectator be unwilling or unable to do this, a historical presentment on an intermittent plan, in which the dramatis personae number some hundreds, exclusive of crowds and armies, becomes in his individual case unsuitable. In this assumption of a completion of the action by those to whom the drama is addressed, it is interesting, if unnecessary, to name an exemplar as old as Aeschylus, whose plays are, as Dr. Verrill reminds us, two scenes from stories taken as known, and would be unintelligible without supplementary scenes of the imagination. Readers will readily discern, too, that the Dynasts is intended simply for mental performance, and not for the stage. Some critics have averred that to declare a drama 3 as being not for the stage is to make an announcement whose subject and predicate cancel each other. The question seems to be an unimportant matter of terminology. Compositions cast in this shape were, without doubt, originally written for the stage only, and as a consequence their nomenclature of CT, scene, and the like, was drawn directly from the vehicle of representation. But in the course of time such a shape would reveal itself to be an eminently readable one. Moreover, by dispensing with the theater altogether, a freedom of treatment was attainable in this form that was denied where the material possibilities of stagery had to be rigorously remembered. With the careless mechanicism of human speech, the technicalities of practical mumming were attained in these productions when they had ceased to be concerned with the stage at all. To say, then, in the present case, that a writing in play shape is not to be played, is merely another way of stating that such writing has been done in a form for which there chances to be no brief definition save one already in use for works, that it superficially, but not entirely resembles. Whether mental performance alone may not eventually be the fate of all drama other than that of contemporary or frivolous life, is a kindred question not without interest. The mind naturally flies to the triumphs of the Hellenic and Elizabethan theater in exhibiting scenes laid are in the unapparent, and asks why they should not be repeated. But the meditative world is older, more invidious, more nervous, more quizzical than it once was, and being unhappily perplexed by riddles of death Thebes never knew, may be less ready and less able than Hellas and Old England were to look through the insistent and often grotesque substance at the thing signified. In respect of such plays of PC and dream, a practicable compromise may conceivably result, taking the shape of a monotonic delivery of speeches, with dreamy conventional gestures, something in the manner traditionally maintained by the old Christmas mummers, the curiously hypnotizing impressiveness of whose automatic style, that of persons who spoke by no will of their own, may be remembered by all who ever experienced it. Gauzes or screens to blur outlines might still further shut off the actual, as has, indeed, already been done in exceptional cases. But with this branch of the subject we are not concerned here. T. H.H. September 1903. Contents. The Dynasts. An epic drama of the war with Napoleon. Preface. Part 1st. Characters. 4 scene. The Overworld. Act 1st. Scene 1. England. Origin Wessex, 2. Paris. Office of the Minister of Marine, 3. London. The Old House of Commons, 4. The Harbour of Bowlen, 5. London. The House of a Lady of Quality, 4. Milan. The Cathedral, Act 2nd. Scene 1. The Dockyard, Gibraltar, 2. Off Farrell, 3. The Camp and Harbour of Bowlen, 4. South Wessex. A ridge like down near the coast, 5. The same. Rainbarrow's Beacon, Egdon Heath, Act 3rd. Scene 1. The Chateau at Pont de Brix, 2. The Frontiers of Upper Austria and Bavaria, 3. Bowlen. The St. Omer Road, Act 4th. Scene 1. King George's Watering Place, South Wessex, 2. Before the City of Ulm, 3. Ulm. Within the City, 4. Before Ulm. The same day, 5. The same. The Michaelsburg, 6. London. Spring Gardens, Act 5th. Scene 1. Off Cape Trafalgar, 2. The same. The quarter deck of the Victory, 3. The same. On board the East Center, 4. The same. The cockpit of the Victory, 5. London. The Guildhall, 6. An Inn at Rennes, 7. King George's Watering Place, South Wessex, Act 6th. Scene 1. The Field of Austerlitz. The French position, 2. The same. The Russian position, 3. The same. The French position, 4. The same. The Russian position, 5. The same. Near the windmill of Paligny, 6. Shockerwick House, near Bath, 7. Paris. A street leading to the Tuileries, 8. Putney. Bowling Green House. Part 2nd. Characters, Act 1st. Scene 1. London. Fox's Lodgings, Arlington Street, 2. The route between London and Paris, 3. The streets of Berlin, 4. The Field of Jena, 5. Berlin. A room overlooking a public place, 6. The same, 7. Tilsit and the River Niemen, 8. The same, Act 2nd. Scene 1. The Pyrenees and valleys adjoining, 2. Aranjuez, near Madrid. A room in the Palace of Godoy, the Prince of Peace, 3. London. The Marchioness of Salisbury's, 4. Madrid and its environs, 5. The open sea between the English coasts and the Spanish Peninsula, 6. St. Cloud. The Boudoir of Josephine, 7. Vimiero, Act 3rd. Scene 1. Spain. A road near Astorga, 2. The same, 3. Before Coruña, 4. Coruña. Near the Ramparts, 5. Vienna. A cafe in the Stephansplatz. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.